You're listening to Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the noisy library of New Zealand music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Come in, Russell Brown.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. You've safely returned from the supermarket.
Yeah, sorry, I timed that wrong, but I just saw a gap in the weather and ran for it.
Has it been raining? Were you on your bicycle?
Actually, no, because I had to take my son to get some stuff as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, but I did have a nice big bike ride today.
Good. Mm. Now, obviously this segment is thanks to audioculture.co.nz. Go check them out. They're like the place to go if you want to find out music, information on music and the history of music in Aotearoa. This evening, Russell, we're talking a Flying Nun prehistory. I mean, I would say there's probably no music in Aotearoa before Flying Nun.
Oh, no, there was plenty. But it's kind of interesting, if you look at audio culture, you'll actually see more and more of our articles are about Christchurch, because quite a lot happened there. And, it's sort of interesting that there's also kind of been a revision in recent years of the way people, especially collectors from overseas, interestingly, perceive Flying Nun. Because at the time, it was kind of all about those young bands from Dunedin. You know, there was the Chills and Sneaky Feelings and so on. And more recently, it's come back around to the weird bohemian fringe, which is very connected with Christchurch's musical past.
Is this kind of beaming straight out of Lyttelton, the bohemian scene, or
no,
Christchurch?
No, pre-Lyttelton. You can imagine a Lyttelton, but in the centre of Christchurch.
Yes.
Because there were, for decades, that's where kind of the weird people lived. There were a lot of big old houses, and it was cheap to live there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of stuff happened. But one really interesting thing about Christchurch is the outside influences that happened.
Where did they come from, and were they?
Well, the big one initially was the American Deep Freeze, Operation Deep Freeze base out at Christchurch Airport, which was actually a military installation at Christchurch Airport, and it was the base for America's Antarctic operations.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a jukebox.
Yes.
And that's where the likes of Max Merritt and the Meteors and Ray Columbus and Dinah Lee and the Chants R&B all got, at least heard, and in some cases got American R&B records. And this was all around the time that the Beatles were doing the same thing in Liverpool, which is kind of interesting. Later on, that base was also said to be the source for quite a lot of LSD and weed that the soldiers would bring over, because they didn't have to go through customs. Mm-hmm. So it had more than one influence on the music scene.
Yes.
And then in the 70s, you got a couple of really interesting characters who came in and were charismatic in their own different ways and kind of introduced people to different kinds of music. One was a guy called Ollie Scott, who I actually met back in the day. Very interesting guy. He was the son of, I think both his parents worked at Bletchley Park during World War II as code breakers. And he turned up in Christchurch and basically started playing everyone he met things like the Stooges. And that
That must have been so powerful
totally. Yeah,
at the time.
1975, this guy arrives and, yeah, listen to these records. And he formed a band called the Detroit Hemorrhoids, who later changed their name to the Basket Cases. And they went on to deliver members to Toy Love, the Gordons, the Androids, Bail to Space, the Playthings, and the Bats.
Mm-hmm.
So it was enormously influential. And then this other guy turned up, a guy called Tony Peake, who was an Australian who took over the loft at the university bookshop in at Canterbury University. And he was quite a different character. He was he was kind but suave. And he would just sit you down. I remember as a school kid going in there, and he'd just sit you down and play you a new record. And you thought it was the coolest thing.
Mm.
So you had that happening. Record shops were actually quite influential too. Roger Shepherd, founder of Flying Nun, founded it from behind the desk at the Record Factory, which was on one side of Cathedral Square. Meanwhile, there was the EMI shop on the other side of Cathedral Square, which was managed by Roy Montgomery, who was the founder of the Pin Group and went on to, you know, a really interesting and extraordinary career. You know, he's still making music, this strange avant-garde guitar music. So he had all these ingredients and this kind of Warholian scene going on.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger has written about it, you know, going to... I can't remember, there was a pub, there was a complete dive bar, and it was kind of like the gay Christchurch hangout, and basically where all the degenerates hung out. And it's sort of interesting that out of that came the Flying Nun milieu, and the Gordons were actually slightly before that, but they were also characterised by something that was really important, which was they made their own art. You know, John Halverson and the Gordons, and later in Balder Space, was a graphic artist, and they had this graphic identity that I don't think you saw it anywhere else in the country. And meanwhile, the likes of the Pin Group had Ronnie Van Hout, who's probably the most notable artist to have come out of Christchurch in my lifetime, who just turned out posters, most of which got ripped down or posted over, and record sleeves, which are immensely collectible now. The Pin Group records go for, you know, hundreds of dollars on Discogs, and they go for that money as much because of Ronnie's screen-printed covers. So you had this sort of weird bohemian thing going on. And the other thing that happened was a guy called Jim Wilson, who would later go on to found Phantom Bill Stickers, started booking gigs. He'd been doing it for a while, organising suburban dances, and he started booking a pub called the Gladstone, which is the absolute centre of the city's musical world. And it was an interesting place because it was actually built in 1856 as the Christchurch Club. And it was built before there was electric power. And yet it turned out to be an amazing rock and roll room. So that, well, if you can imagine a bar that, much as we love our K Road venues, you know, the things will be going quite well if there's, you know, 50 people in there on a Friday night, some of those bars.
Mm.
The Gladstone will have 200 people on a weeknight.
Wow.
And it was partly because there was fuck all else to do, and TV finished early, and the pubs closed early as well, so you could actually go to the pub, see two bands, get back in time for the late news on TV. There was a lot, yeah, and at that time also you had this other big pub called the Hillsborough, which could hold 1,100 people, and there were nights when both pubs were absolutely rammed. And that was also where the Dunedin bands, they came up, and that was where they played to their first big crowds. So, you know, Flying Nun didn't just appear. It really came out of all these factors, all these outside influences, and most of all, this incredible live scene. I was just the right age to enjoy it. Maybe a couple of years too young, because we used to have to sneak into the Gladstone, but they let us. So it was a really fascinating time, and it's interesting that some of the records that might have been overlooked in favour of the Chills and the Verlaines back in the day, you know, things like the Victor Dimisich band, who became the Terminals, they made one record which came out well after they'd broken up, but it's a weird, spooky, bohemian record, and there are a few examples of that. And I think one that you've got lined up to play is the Playthings,
mm-hmm.
Who were amazing. Jay Clarkson was one of two women in that band. The other one was Janine Saundercock, and Their song Sit Down, I just think, is one of the best records of that era. It was actually recorded live at the Gladstone, and when it was mastered for recording, it was slightly too fast, but hey, it didn't matter.
All right, let's hear it, Russell.
Okay.
Russell Brown on the phone from Audio Culture, chatting about pre-Flying Nun tunes. Russell, I kind of picked up, are you from Christchurch?
Yeah, I mostly grew up there, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I sort of lived all over as a kid, but most of the time in Christchurch. Went to school with John Key.
Oh,
it's weird. No one can remember him.
How does the geography of Christchurch? Well, how would you say that the geography of Christchurch lends itself to creativity and music?
Yeah, interesting question. Because Christchurch is pretty flat, and it all happened kind of in the centre of the flat bit, which is largely not there now because of the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
Because it turned out to be not a very good place to build.
Mm.
So I think that. And then you had, there was a lot of space to expand. I mean, I went to Burnside High in the northwest, and our local band was the Voxels,
mm-hmm.
who were this amazing sort of fast R&B punk three-piece. Who just played, incredibly fast all the time, and played all kinds of weird stuff like, ad jingles and things like that, all at the same speed.
Hmm.
So it was kind of neat having, them at school. I think they even played once, and they weren't terribly good school attenders. I think they'd occasionally jump over the fence and go to a class, but you had that. I think I guess one thing is there was a lot of space.
Mm-hmm.
And there were quite a lot of suburban halls. So, again, with this live scene, there were, even if you were underage, there were places to go.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the equivalent of blue light discos. I think we called them something else, or they were called something else in Christchurch. But there were, it was very easy as a teenager to get to see live music,
mm-hmm.
which, is not necessarily the case now.
For sure, yeah.
Anywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I definitely hear that. You've obviously written a series of articles for Audio Culture. What are some other nuggets from this pre-history of Flying Nun that you have to share with us?
I it's probably worth talking about the art because, you know, which I mentioned before. I mean, Roger had always kind of thought of Christchurch as an arty city. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he first started as a school kid, you know, behind the counter at the record factory, one of the great things for him was that all these really cool and interesting people would come in and invite him to parties where they played the Bryan Ferry albums, which was, you know, considered extremely, you know, sophisticated back then.
Mm-hmm.
But you also had, you know, most of those bands had either within the band or in the group around them, someone to give them a visual identity. I mean, the obvious one, as I mentioned before, was the Pin Group with Ronnie's amazing screen printing. But you also had, I mean, have you ever had Stuart Page on the show?
No, I haven't met Stuart Page.
Yeah, he's an artist and photographer. And he was at the art school there. And he got into screen printing as well, which was, it was sort of interesting. I've talked to him about it, and he said, yeah, the senior teachers at the art school, you know, thought, why on earth would you want to do screen printing? Oh, my goodness, you know.
Mm.
So, you know, it seemed like a ruffian thing to do, and that was exactly what appealed. And, you know, and the fact that you could kind of, you know, you could print your pictures was, you know, like with the X-Men, they initially put out cassettes, but they put them out in full-size 12-inch sleeves because Stu couldn't resist the chance to actually make these amazing sleeves. And again, they're collectible as much for the art they came in as for the music that was inside.
Mm-hmm.
Another really interesting person was Leslie McLean, who I also went to school with, who was the kind of weird, super bright girl at school who didn't go to the art school but went to the tech design course. And she actually did quite a lot of work for Flying Nun early on. And a lot of the early Flying Nun ads that you might see here, you know, around were actually her work. And it's kind of interesting because most of those were photomechanically reproduced, but the kind of vibe of the screen printers had come through, and you got this really sort of quite gutsy, visceral thing about everyone's work. Yeah, and that was, yeah, it was really interesting. And then, of course, you also had strange characters like Bill Doreen, who was a bit older than everyone else and sort of slightly stood off to one side, but had a band called The Vacuum,
mm-hmm.
who were clearly very, very influenced by the Velvet Underground. And there was this kind of Warholian tone to, you know, the inner city as well. I mean, Ronnie made these kind of very Warhol-type movies of people in the scene. But Bill also, you know, he's a writer as well as a musician, and he even formed a theatre group called Soluble Fish, and that's another extremely collectible record.
Mm-hmm.
But he made these, you know, the string of records that, you know, the original pressings were like 100 or 200 copies.
Mm. Would they be being pressed in New Zealand at the time or out of Australia?
Back then you could get your records pressed. The two pressing plants in the country were both in Wellington, the EMI and Polygram. And, you know, so you could do it. There weren't very good pressings. That was the problem. They often, you know, I think they were often not left to cool properly or something.
Mm.
And, of course, you know, no one knew how to do anything, so people didn't know how to master their records well either.
Yes.
and it's sort of interesting. So, I mean, some of those early Flying Nun records don't sound great now.
Yes.
You know, those pressings.
Yeah.
That Playthings record for some reason does, you know, I play that down at Cupid.
Yep.
And it sounds fucking great.
Yeah.
You know, it still does. So yeah, you had all these things going on, and then out of nowhere, Bill wins the Battle of the Bands in Christchurch,
mm-hmm.
at the Star and Garter, which was another venue that was operating at the time. It may have had something to do with the fact that Roger Shepherd was one of the judges, but So Bill Doreen wins the Battle of the Bands, gets recording time in Auckland at Progressive, hooks up with Chris Knox and Doug Hood, and makes the first Builders album, Beaten Hearts. And it was a strange way for it to happen, but Christchurch did always have this this sort of juxtaposition of the quite commercial and the weird and bohemian. You know, it was also the city where the dance exponents took off,
mm-hmm.
and of course it was home to Houghton Hughes Music World label, which was I don't know, your older listeners may remember Music World. It put out a lot of terrible sound-alike type records, easy listening. Its biggest album ever was in 1978, in the midst of punk, Golden Saxophones. And it sold hundreds of thousands of copies. It was huge.
Golden Saxophones.
Yeah, but I mean, it was. But weirdly enough, it was also the label that released, like, the Wailers' African Herbsman.
Okay.
Because that didn't have a major label distribution deal,
mm-hmm.
so he picked that up and released it in the original sleeve. It was kind of neat, but it sort of, there was always the suspicion that you know, anything on Music World, even if it was by an artist, you know, a well-known artist, may actually have been, you know, recorded by a pub covers band in Hornby or something, but, you know, who knows? So, yeah, it was. There's more, yeah, again, come back to that thing, there was more going on than people think.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the height of it didn't last very long. I mean, the Gladstone was really only the Gladstone for about 2.5 years.
Mm.
And yet it seemed like the absolute centre of the world at the time, you know, because you had all the Flying Nun bands coming through, the Propeller bands played there. And like I said, you could go and see bands there 5 nights a week some weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that was also where the Androids played and legendarily set a record for the bar take that was never bettered.
Wow.
And that was at the same time, same night, that the Swingers were across town at the Hillsborough and packed 1,100 people in there. So, you know, and it's not a very big town.
Mm.
I think the population at the time was about 200,000. So,
you got a good proportion of people in the pub.
Exactly. Yeah, because there wasn't much else to do, I think.
Yeah. Hey, we do have the Builders Russian Rug edit lined up,
mm-hmm.
clocking in at 6:10. Shall we crank it?
Yeah, get that psychedelic groove happening.
Okay.
Cool.
Ride down deep in a Russian ride.
Elders, Russian Rug, as selected by Russell Brown. Hey, Russell.
Mm-hmm.
Had Can made a fairly good sort of, or had they made a fairly good grip on Christchurch at this stage?
Yeah, that, well, interesting. I know that, like, the Kilgours, who formed the Clean, were huge Can fans. I'm not sure whether it was such a big deal there.
Mm-hmm.
But I totally get why you would ask that. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, interesting point, yeah. There were influences like that for sure, you know, and you know, you get to bands like the Gordons, who appeared just before Flying Nun started, and they, I mean, there were still punk rock bands around at that point, and they weren't a punk rock band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were, you know, enabled by punk. You know, if you can't imagine them ever being allowed to play in a pub if punk hadn't happened. But yeah, they had, you know, all those kind of avant-garde influences, and apart from anything else, were absolutely incredibly loud.
Russell Brown, if you were going to speculate on the one band from abroad, the one international band that had played the biggest influence on Flying Nun and the Flying Nun sort of artists, what band would that be?
I think they all claim different ones. I mean, Sneaky Feelings reckoned they were all about Arthur Lee and Love, and like I said, the Kilgours loved their kraut rock. But I guess you would have to go with the Velvet Underground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Pretty safe bet. Yep.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. Yep.
Hmm.
Not good.
Now you've got the Gordons lined up there.
I do.
You?
I've got Coal Miner's Song. Can you tell me about this, Russell Brown?
Okay. Well, the Gordons' sort of origin story is interesting because I mentioned Jim Wilson before, and he was booking the Hillsborough, and he said to John Halverson, "Hey, I've got a support slot for this Auckland band, The Plague. Do you want to get together a band?" And they got together a band and wrote something like 8 songs that week and played and blew everyone away.
Mm-hmm.
But then had to play them again by popular demand, but, you know, legendarily. But the interesting thing about them was that they kind of came right off the bat with a visual image of what the music was about, and I think I wrote in Canvas that they weren't just a band, they were a cultural idea.
Mm-hmm.
Their first album, the second one, not so much. They made an EP called Future Shock that they went to Wellington to record, and then for the Gordons. Which I and a lot of other people think is sort of one of the most important records ever made here. They went up to Harlequin Studios in Auckland and basically locked the doors for 48 hours and made this incredible record. It's a sonic experience, this record.
Mm-hmm.
Coal Miner's Song is one of the more laid-back ones, put it that way.
Excellent. Hey, Russell Brown from Audio Culture, thank you very much for jumping on the phone with us this evening.
Yeah, cheers. Sorry I missed you initially, but...
That's all right. The thing is, after 6, we get a bit more time, so...
Yeah, indeed. That's great then.
We've had, sort of 40 minutes versus like 25, so...
Gods, has it been that long?
Anyone out there, head along to Audio Culture. Russell Brown has got a bunch of articles up on Flying Nun prehistory. Get amongst, check it out. Audio Culture is obviously a fantastic resource for buffing up on some crucial New Zealand music history. Russell, thank you very much.
Cheers, Johnny. Thank you. Bye. It was always a pleasure.
Cheers, mate.
Okay, bye.
Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz. It's just fascination.
The products I'm taking up